and welcome to Robbinsdale Revisited. I'm Pete Ritchie, the president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society. In this episode of Robbinsdale Revisited, we uncover the extraordinary life of Amy Robbins Ware. Writer, artist, architect, veteran, and one of the most fascinating members of the Robbins family. Drawing from her personal letters, wartime writings, and the pages of her book, The Echoes of France, we follow Amy from the cultural world of early Robbinsdale to the front lines of World War I France, where she served beside the ambulance corps and field hospitals during some of the war's deadliest battles. Along the way, we explore her fierce determination to have her service recognized, her lifelong passion for art and education, and the legacy she left behind as an advocate for veterans, peace, and community life in Robbinsdale. So join me and Crystal Boyd as we explore the life of Amy Robbins Ware.
We're talking about Amy Robbins Ware, who has always been my favorite of the Robbins daughters. As we're digging through her letters, we have all this stuff spread out in front of us right now, and she left behind quite a bundle of letters and all the notes for her book, The Echoes of France. And as we dig through this, I find, you know, letter after letter, she's trying to make sure that her service was recognized. I mean, 2 years in France, working as a canteen worker, being among the ambulance corps right on the front lines during the Argonne and all these really bloody trench battles. Some time in the south of France, teaching radio operations and telegraphy to soldiers. And when she gets home, her service was not always recognized by organizations like the American Legion or the Social Register.
Robbinsdale, Minnesota, October 26th, 1920. Social Register Association, Bowling Green, New York. Dear sirs, I am enclosing a check for the last issue of the Register. I was, however, much annoyed at the omission of the service star with my name. My record, with the statement that I had received an honorable discharge from the Army, was sent with the data in my letter, or rather, the blank you sent to be filled out. Inasmuch as my commanding officer in France gave me the authorization for wearing stars on the Liberty Bar for the St. Mihiel and Argonne drives, and two Army service stripes, I cannot see why the Register should not recognize my record. I am also a full-fledged member of the American Legion and not in the least ashamed of it. I know that there were not many women of your patrons who were in the Army proper. Most of my friends were in the Red Cross only. That was my capacity at first, but I was transferred in France when they needed me. Respectfully, Mrs. Amy Robbins Ware, Robbinsdale, Minnesota.
Amy was a bit of a club woman. Really not a term you hear now, but there was the tourist club, there was the library club, there was the ladies auxiliary, there was a crafts guild, and there were all these clubs. Sometimes they just show up in the newspaper and there's always a portrait of these women on the social pages and our new president or, you know, our chairman. And Amy was often featured that way. Amy's born in 1877, and we know that she's born at her uncle T.B. Walker's house. And was this why she loved art so much? And she spent a lot of time in his home. Even growing up, she would go down there, and at one point she brings pictures from his house and from the art museum out here to the Robbins house and invites everybody over in the tourist club to have a look at all the paintings. Kind of a big overview. I think of her as an American author, a world court worker. She wrote all these documents and made all these proposals as they were putting together the world court for the League of Nations. And she was, there's some correspondence between her and Woodrow Wilson. I think it's just sort of a letter of thank you for your support in this. And of course, we didn't join the League of Nations, so it's not that all of her work was for naught. It may have laid the foundation for some sort of human rights thing. But we can say, at least in that context, she was a bit of a peace activist. She was stationed near the front lines in the days leading up to the armistice of November 11th, 1918, and later became associated with the Army College at Savenay. She documented her entire experience in this wonderful little book called The Echoes of France, and she designed the cover for it. She had some experience in an arts and crafts guild. So she did the cover and, you know, some of these nice fonts and letterings that appear throughout the book. It's lavishly illustrated. And if you look closely, she appears in most of the pictures. A lot of the pictures are of the ambulance corps or of working in the canteen, or there'll be a number of people standing around a tank. And if you look closely, you'll see Amy among those people. Sometimes she has a gas mask. So Amy had a lifelong passion for art, growing up wandering around T.B. Walker's mansion, helping him select artworks for his collection. From the age of 8, she developed a love of the violin. She was serious about it. It was just part of being upper class that you were going to learn an instrument and be good at it. So graduated from East High School, and strangely enough, that's where Edith went to. But I know that Edith and Amy both went to East High School, and I know they got there on the streetcar because it's mentioned in a few of these little letters. It might have been kind of a trek from where their house was on Twin Lakes, so you probably picked it up here at 42nd and West Broadway, and you went down Broadway, and eventually you cut across at about 36th and ended up on Thomas Avenue, and then you must have had to go pretty much to downtown Minneapolis. Maybe you got off there and walked across the bridge. East High School was about where I think of it in the neighborhood of St. Anthony, Maine. So she graduates from East High School in 1896, specializing in architecture, and she practiced the profession until 1898, including a year's apprenticeship at the Tagger Agricultural Offices. In 1901, she received a bachelor's degree, a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Minnesota, where she studied botany, chemistry, and modern languages. She furthered her education in applied design, wood carving, leatherwork, and jewelry making at the Minneapolis Handicraft Guild from 1905 to 1906, and she received a Master's of Arts degree in 1907 from the University of Minnesota, majoring in dramaturgy? Is that a word?
Sure.
What is dramaturgy?
I think it's theater.
We'll get to that. She's had some theater experience, and I know that she wrote a couple plays that were performed at the University of Minnesota. Dramaturgy, historic design, and archaeology. So
she did everything.
Yeah.
That's the list of everything.
Well, one of my favorite quotes from Amy Robbins, she says, "People say there aren't enough minutes in the day to get everything done, but there are. You just have to use every one." On January 3rd, 1907, Amy became a founding member and secretary of the Robbinsdale Library Club. At that time, the books were available from 9 to 4 on weekends at the Robbinsdale State Bank, and the members voted to contribute an additional dollar a month to the salary of the librarian. For a while, the village council would kick in a dollar, but decided that this was too much and they couldn't afford the expense. They allowed the library club to keep their books at the village hall rather than the bank. We also know that the village hall provided lighting because they noted this, that they were providing some electrical lights for the library club. On August 14th, 1907, at the age of 29, Amy Robbins married her college beau, John J. Rowland, at her family's home in Robbinsdale. They like to have the weddings right here at the bride's house, and I'm sure it was an elaborate affair. Andrew B. Robbins was still alive, and he was probably hiring a team to go up and down the streets and sprinkle water on the dirt streets so that women's dresses wouldn't get all dusty. And we have Edith Robbins was the maid of honor. Pascal Ware, the brother of the bridegroom, was the best man. And Esther and Ruth Robbins stretched the ribbons. The couple resided at 3914 West Broadway. And this was a little home that I'm sure Amy designed and had built. It was a gift from her parents. John Rowland Ware, by all accounts, he was a lawyer. He must have made some money doing something at some time, but there's no indication that this was ever a happy marriage. We'll get to that a little later. So they end up living at this little house. Amy called it the Orchards, which is also the name that Andrew B. Robbins called his house in that area. So I can't tell. You know, the properties were not contiguous. This house sat about where Robin's Landing is now, and it had a piece of property that went down to Crystal Lake. Amy established the Orchard Crafts Guild, gathering a bunch of women. I think of the arts and crafts movement not only as architecture, but as furniture, and people like Frank Lloyd Wright came out of this. So in 1913 and part of 1914, Amy travels through Europe with her mother and other family members, including Sister Ruth and her husband, Dr. Fred Rhoda, her sister Adelaide, and her son Louis, and a cousin named Ann Walker, and the journey allowed her to continue her studies in architecture and craft work. In 1916, Amy appears as Friar Francis in a local production of Much Ado About Nothing at the Schubert Theater on Hampton Avenue. And so the Minneapolis Journal noted, with much ado, though mentors of youth forbid them to take feminine parts on the stage for fear that they'll grow effeminate, Charles M. Holt, director of the cast of Young Women, to put on Much Ado About Nothing at the Schubert Theater tonight, isn't afraid that the masculine roles will make them mannish. So all female cast, and they raised money for the College Women's Club and a scholarship fund.
The Minneapolis Journal from March 17, 1918 says, radio expert on way to France. Mrs. J.R. Ware, Amy Robbins, has gone to New York on her way to France. She goes under the auspices of the Red Cross and the federal government to do canteen work and radio telegraphy. Mrs. Ware was the first here to qualify for the radio telegraphy service and to offer her services to the government after she had passed examinations in intensive training and advanced courses. She also was the first to teach radio telegraphy to classes of girls here. I wonder how she got into radio. I mean, she was hands-on with her arts and crafts stuff, right?
I don't know that there were a lot of commercial radio stations at that point. The whole idea that you're going to radio somebody, you know, it must have been really, really exciting. So she was accepted as a canteen worker by the American Red Cross and sailed for France on the SS La Touraine on March 14th, 1918. So she's first stationed at the 3rd Aviation Instruction Center. Then she continues to teach radio technology to military observers while working for the Red Cross canteen during the day. And when the Red Cross called for volunteers to serve near the front, she joined an emergency canteen and nursing unit serving in the Argonne Offensive, September 1918. She was under fire with the Field Hospital number 41, where she was the only woman present.
Do you think she had any sense of what was in store for her?
I wonder if anybody had any sense of what was in store for them in World War One. You know, when we look at this account from her mother serving as a nurse during the Civil War, and her father certainly spending time talking to her about the Civil War, my guess is she was, if not prepared, at least had some idea.
I was thinking about the differences between the Civil War and World War One. Definitely both brutal wars, but the technology and maybe the pace of World War One. You're right. I don't know that anybody was ready.
Yeah, just the amount of munitions in the air, enough bullets that, you know, that the sky darkens because there's that much, just the smoke and terror and these people pinned down to trenches. The use of barbed wire, the use of poison gas thing. And we see Amy Robbins in various pictures with the gas mask. But she certainly encountered a lot of brutality, and working in an ambulance corps, that meant she was riding, you know, up close to the front, picking up patients, coming back to wherever the little hospital was, and then going back and forth and back and forth.
And for all her training, none of it was medical.
Maybe just being kind and compassionate and, you know, reading through Echoes of France and her descriptions of the soldiers that she encountered and just the love she felt for them. It had to have helped, even without the medical training. So Amy observed and recorded maneuvers of aviators, describing her first air battle in Echoes of France under the title Birds of Night. She continued working for the evacuation hospital number 9 and number 11 until December 8, 1918. Her intense dedication led to exhaustion, and in January 1919, she was sent to the French Riviera to recuperate. And of all the places I would like to recuperate, I think the French Riviera is right up there. And I'm sure it was beautiful in 1919 as it is now. And I can only imagine what the beaches were like.
I think it was really beautiful. We have a little letter and she does talk about how gorgeous it is. But she tells her family, like, don't tell anyone I'm here. I don't want them to think I'm not working. She's like really worried that it's going to get out that she wasn't 101,000,000% dedicated every minute of every day to this exhausting war. Antibes, January 18th, 1919. A handwritten note at the top says the wrong address was because one letter came on stationery of the 45th, and I thought I had missed the probable news of a transfer. Then, in typewriting, "Dear family, the slide thing on this little animal is a little bit stiff, so it doesn't come back right away after the capital key raises the carriage, hence the letters sitting below the lines. After a bit, it will limber up and be all fine again. I'm going to do something that I didn't think I should ever do. That is send carbon letters to any of you. This will be to Mother and those at home, and one which I will ask you to mail to Adelaide and Lewis because I've come away without their address, and one I am sending to Esther. The idea was suggested by your sending copies to the distant members. I shall write just as many times, only you will all get them at once instead of successively. You are probably wondering why this comes from the south of France when I am, to the best of your knowledge and belief, in Gay Paris. I will elucidate. I had a cold, had it when Fred was here, so you can find out for yourselves that I am not deceiving you when I say it was not at all a serious one. After I had all the requisitions in for supplies for the new canteen, which I was to have at the Quai d'Orsay, I still had a little cold. Then the Seine took a notion to get full. That closed the station for a time, and the building isn't quite finished either. The Red Cross man in charge of our department, Major Boyer, said for me to go south, as it was too rainy in Paris for me to shake the cold there. I said it would cost a lot, and I was sure I would be ready when the work was. What do you suppose he did? He went and had a pass made for me to come to this little bit of heaven with my transportation and board, and I was issued a paybook for 30 francs a day, beginning on the 1st of January and to the 1st of July. So here I am, naturally, and will go back directly. You see, the hardships of the service at the front were no idle dream, and we were more exhausted than one would imagine. That was why we took colds and things so easily. Thank fortune I didn't get the flu. Lots of people did. But those in charge are determined to take care of us, both in prevention and in case of actual illness. I am telling you all this so you will realize that the Red Cross is mothering us as well as the boys. I don't care where you have been, you've never seen such a perfect place as this. I am sitting at my little table at the open window, looking out as I type. That may explain some of the letters you are seeing double. Across the bay at the snow-capped mountains. This morning, we went for a walk around a point that turns out into the blue-green water of the Mediterranean. Oranges are everywhere, and soft green olive trees, and palms, and palmette. The coast of Italy at Sorrento is much the same, only this is a perfectly kept in the part of the shore on which the hotel is situated, and makes the wild places all the more beautiful by contrast. I had some chocolate candy which I was eating along, and while I wasn't looking, the sun came in at the window and melted it. Please don't tell anyone these things, because they would surely think I was a loafer. This would be remembered to the exclusion of everything else. I am so glad to be able to give you all the assurance that it is not all hard, because you will understand and rejoice for me. My Christmas box has not been delivered to me yet. There were so many that lots of them are still in the basement of the Regina, yet waiting to be sorted out, mine among them, I presume. You remember one Christmas Adelaide gave me an outfit of toilet articles? She will remember anyway, because she paid for them. Well, with the check from her and Lewis, and the one Fred and Ruth gave me, I did the same. Those things I had for years, and these I will also, and they make me feel like a very civilized person. You can hardly believe how necessary it was to regain the habits of real life after I came back. But I am in a fair way to go to the other extreme, at the place they have sent me now. Of course, I have not signed up for any longer than my year, which is up the 14th of March. But you see, it would be possible for me to stay through June as far as the money goes. Please let me know what you think I should do. This town of Antibes is small and may not be on the maps you have at home, in case you want to look me up. So I am going to tell you a little bit about its position. It is a little trip to Nice, where one may drive in a day, see the sights at that place and return, or you can go in the same way to Monte Carlo, or by boat to the islands hereabout. It is here that the tower is located, in which the man was imprisoned with the iron mask, and various other things of interest. I am going to stay in this hotel for a few days, and then go down to Nice for a jaunt, before I go back to work. You don't know how queer it seems not to have anything to do. I believe they were right, and that I will be enough more keen and have enough more enthusiasm to carry on when I get back, to make up for seemingly lost time. I only wish I could gather all of you into my arms and tote you down here onto the beach in this love of a place. How we would all enjoy it, wouldn't we? I suppose the place where Adelaide and Louis are living is something like it, because one of the girls here is from Pasadena, and it makes her homesick. It is so much like home. Miss Bradford. The pictures of Panama look as if it too was a beautiful place. And surely I think there is no place like Robbinsdale, so I can't be very sad about you. Only it would be such fun to be all together. I wonder if Ruth received the telegram in time to make the dock? They told me that the boat would get in on the 31st, and I figured that if she received the cable in time, they would have New Year's Day together. I had a letter from her the day I left Paris, in which she was just leaving for some port or other, and I was quite exercised to know if she was there when the cable arrived. Also, did a letter ever get to you with the cock and snail pins? There are a few little things that I have, which I would like to send in letters if things are getting through all right. Nothing of any great value, only it is no use to have anything lost in order to get there sooner, now that the season of gifts is past anyway. Fred was going to take a little book to Helen Mary, but we were so flurried at the last minute that we didn't stop at my hotel for them. I am also wondering if he got a seat on the train to Bordeaux. Did the Kodak pictures of Helen Mary come out all right, the ones in her new coat? I am hoping that they will be in the Christmas box when I get back to my work. Also, I hope for beaucoup letters. I've been a heathen about answering the nice notes so many people sent me at Christmas time, and I was such a goose, I never brought the addresses with me to this place where I have the job the old lady picked out for heaven. Nothing to do forever and ever. It's a shame, and I can't use the old standby phrase that has covered all emergencies for the last year, c'est la guerre, because there is no more guerre. So I'll just have to admit that I'm a bum. The sun shines right up the walk of the hotel and directly into my room, and before it reaches the walk, it crosses the mountains and builds a bridge for itself across the Bay of Blue. This would be adequate reward for a lifetime of service, rather than for a mere 10 months. 10 months! I can't realize that it is as long as that. It seems such a little time since I left Mother on the dock at New York. The sun is sinking behind the mountains, and now will begin the glory that is sunset here, really indescribable. Please remember not to say things about my paybook and this trip to the outside world. It is nobody's business, at least that is the way I feel about it. I might go and watch the colors change over the incomparable land and waterscape. So good night, all the buddies. Until next time, yours truly, Amy Robbins Ware, ARC Canteen Service, Hotel Regina, Paris. And as a little postscript, dear Wright, I'm awfully glad your wife is clean. I've been so far removed from tubs and shampoos for 3 months that was a pleasant piece of news. Thanks, boy.
On April 15, 1919, she's transferred from the Red Cross to the Army and became a faculty member at the University of the American Expeditionary Forces in Savenay Hospital. So she taught architecture, mechanical drawing, and lettering for 4 months before returning to the United States, where she was honorably discharged in New York City on June 14th, 1919. I really think this was the defining moment of her life. And at this time, she's in her 40s. It's not like she's a young woman taking this on.
Pete, remind me, has her husband come and gone by this time? How did that work out?
So they're officially divorced, I believe we found something that said 1920. Again, one of my favorite little quotes of these letters back and forth from Robin's family is Edith is informing T.B. Walker, Uncle T.B. there, that Amy is headed off to France and that she's boarding a steamer in New York. And T.B. says, you know, boarding a steamer, I would have thought she would have been paddling her own canoe across the pond. So she was really determined. And I think I've read a few accounts of women that were serving during World War I, and there's actually a couple other women from Robbinsdale that went over and worked in canteens, etc. They were motivated by patriotism, a sense of duty. It was also, if you were not in a marriage that was working out, this was a way to get away from your husband, and that's never going to be stated in this, but she gets back in 1919, and they're divorced in 1920, and again, there was just no indication that I can find anywhere that this was a happy marriage. So the Farnham Company published Ware's book, Echoes of France, in 1920. So Ware's writing mixed deep emotion and a touch of humor. She described a frantic search for eggs in the pouring rain to feed her patients and the challenges of making puddings and chocolate on an army stove with a pipe that was too short. Terror, restless labor, overwhelming sorrow that must have weighed on the women who served were all captured in her verse. She paid a heartfelt tribute to the indomitable spirit of the American soldier. The small book reflected the unwavering devotion of American women who stood by soldiers until the very end. For those who mourned, it served as a true message of hope and comfort. And I know that she was corresponding with a family of one of the men that was in her care that passed away and wanted to make sure that they knew that he loved them and that he died, you know, bravely for the cause. The volume featured an introduction by Richard Burton, but not the Richard Burton, the University of Minnesota Richard Burton, and a preface by Edmund Bayer of the University of Cincinnati, who was one of her fellow workers over there. The cover, designed by the author, captured a scene evocative of her time in France. And so upon returning to Minnesota, she goes back to work for public service in 1920. She joined the government service as a teacher at the Army School at Fort Snelling and held that position until July of 1921. She also worked at the ER Special Summer School at Camp Grant, Illinois. Looking for an opportunity during the Prohibition era, Amy and her sister Edith remodeled an older house as an office for a new business known as the Jefferson Highway Tea Shop. And the pair spent weekends at the gravel pit picking out stones for the entrance pillars and the fireplace. And from here, they managed the estate of Andrew B. Robbins, the Robbinsdale Insurance and Loan Company. The office and / tea shop building was on the west side of Broadway, just a little north of 42nd. There's a funeral home now. The building was torn down in the 1970s to make way for that funeral home. After it was done being used as a business office for Amy and Edith, it was used for gatherings. We have pictures of gatherings of all the firemen in town, and they're having a banquet. So it had this good-sized room where those giant stone fireplaces were, and you can see these guys gathered around. So we know the house was used for a number of years after that. I know Edith lived in it for a little while. And the tea shop never really took off, Mrs. Shumway noting that maybe they would just go ask T.B. Walker to help them get started with this tea shop, and then it would fail, and they'd go ask him for money again, which seems to be a pattern among the Robins. But they did make some money selling real estate. I don't know how well they did in the insurance business. These letters often indicate that they're about to sell a lot, and they're quite thrilled because they need the cash to maintain their lavish lifestyles. So in 1922, Edith and Amy become tireless advocates for a proposed veterans hospital in Robbinsdale. They were certainly advocates for Victor Memorial Drive and had been corresponding with this French general to see if he could come to help dedicate the drive. Alongside with Dr. B.F. Robbins, they worked to promote the site and gain support from Congressman Walter H. Newton and other officials. They believed the Robbinsdale location was ideal because of its proximity to Minneapolis, sitting just north of Rockford Road and about 2 miles west of the city along a planned extension of Victor Memorial Drive at 44th Avenue North. Plans for the hospital included a 500-bed facility, and it would be dedicated primarily to mental health care. Again, World War I, you're looking at people coming back shell-shocked and dealing with what is now post-traumatic stress syndrome, etc. And so I think there was certainly a need to support the project. Amy and Edith helped organize fundraising campaigns across Hennepin County and the state, securing commitments from 16 farmers who agreed to sell their land for the site of the new Veterans Hospital. Infrastructure improvements were also planned, including an extension of Victor Memorial Drive, leading directly to the hospital grounds. A key feature of the proposal was to make a concrete bridge over Twin Lake, along with a wide landscaped strip of land on both sides of the drive to create this attractive approach to the facility. Additionally, streetcar lines were expected to be extended to the hospital, and nearby railroad lines were considered for potential depot locations to improve accessibility. in the idea and gained all sorts of enthusiasm. There was even a bold headline in the Star, you know, in the Tribune, saying that the new Veterans Hospital, the site for Robbinsdale, is perfect. It's been chosen. And it all crashed and burned. They never raised enough money. The farmers and the landowners along the route were not going to just donate their land. They had the land for free. The Veterans Administration would come out here and build, but they could not get all the land secured. The idea gained the enthusiasm of local business leaders and initial interest from government officials, such as Colonel Charles R. Forbes, the first director of the Veterans Bureau. However, a site near Fort Stelling was chosen for the Veterans Hospital instead. But I still think we're a little closer to downtown than that South Minneapolis location. But there was already a great big veterans building down there, and there was a soldier's home right by Minnehaha Falls. And so a lot of the infrastructure was already in place. It would have been glorious, though. And they, at one point, they sketched out plans, and you can see these big buildings on either side, mostly on the Robbinsdale side of Victor Memorial Drive and the planned extension, and the giant roundabout and parkway, and with all of its monuments. And we have a quiet monument to World War I here. It's beautiful in its own way, and the fact that it's trees is apropos to Robbinsdale. Amy actively engaged in international peace efforts in 1925 as chair of the Department of International Cooperation for the Minnesota Federation of Women's Clubs. She mobilized 50,000 club women to advocate for international cooperation, believing informed women could help prevent future wars. Her advocacy for the Permanent Court of International Justice earned her a personal commendation from President Warren G. Harding. She also gave radio talks on peace and international relations for the League of Women Voters. In addition to the League, she was actively involved in other organizations, including the Daughters of the American Revolution, the Business Women's Club of Minneapolis, and the General Federation of Women's Clubs. She was also a violinist, again, in the community orchestra. Amy passed away unexpectedly from a cerebral hemorrhage at Abbott Hospital in Minneapolis on May 5th, 1929, and she was only 51 years old. Her funeral was held at Lakewood Chapel and attended by representatives from the Women's Overseas Service League, the Women's Relief Corps, the American Legion, and the Legion Auxiliary. A detachment of soldiers from Fort Snelling served as pallbearers, and a bugler played taps in her honor. She was laid to rest in the Robbins family plot at Lakewood Cemetery, and Amy Robbins left behind a legacy of service, advocacy, and dedication to international peace. Her contributions to women's education, military service, and global diplomacy remain a testament to her unwavering commitment, progress, and justice.
Pete, you mentioned that Amy is your favorite of the five Robbins
sisters.
Why is Amy your favorite?
I don't know. I just have a crush on her. She kind of captured my imagination when I first started reading about the Robbins family. The other thing is we have so much written material from her. Not only do we have the book, we have the notes for the book, we have all these letters, and her personality comes through in those letters in ways that that just tickle me. And you can just tell that she was not a woman to be trifled with. She was she was serious. She meant it, and she got a lot done. You can just tell that she was motivated and determined.
Yeah, like forged in the fire. Sensitive, writing her poetry, but with a real mission. What year did she pass away?
1929. Maybe a life too short, a full life at 51.
And kept active through that whole life, from the war to coming back, publishing her book, getting divorced, doing the tea shop, being feisty about getting recognition as a veteran. I mean, she had a full decade there.
And I think, you know, some of her work as in the real estate business. Again, there's a newspaper article. The first time I came across it, I was really impressed, and I found a little bit more information as I went through. But it is kind of a piece of advertising, and it shows this row of houses that is just south of Grazier Park. There are a variety of styles rather than all being one. They're not all bungalow. They're not all four square. There's a little Tudor among them. You know, this was an advertising for their real estate agency. And from what I understand, she had a lot to do with these houses and their designs and the way they were laid out. And I think they're all still there.
Yeah. Designed by Roy E. Skipton of the McAnulty Company in collaboration with Amy Robbins Ware.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. And bus back home sitting hand in hand when the evening ends. When the evening ends. When the evening ends. In Robbinsdale.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.
The end.